We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both formerly with Eat This State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. A lot to cover this week, as there is every week, starting with local and one of which was very surprising and shocking to me, a couple announcements of city council members choosing not to run again.
Yeah, we thought there would be a lot of interesting things going on this year with the implementation of the new district system that was passed in Charter Amendment 19 2 years ago, and that meaning that all nine council members were up for re-election this year, and it was thought that all nine of them would run for re-election, but two announcing their retirement this week. Nick Licata, who was in the same district as Michael Bryan, and they'd been trying to figure out which of them would run in their district and which of them would run at large. We already have two other incumbent council members, Tim Burgess and Sally Clark, running in at large because both of them also are in the same district as other council incumbents. And so either Nick nor Mike was faced with the prospect of running against a fellow council member, or they would run against each other as two of the more liberal members on the council. Instead, Licata deciding to retire after 18 years on the council, and he has for most of that time been the most progressive person on council and responsible for an awful lot of both high-profile and not high-profile actions by city council that have been among the best things that they've done. For instance, the family and sick leave ordinance that was passed a couple of years ago, and you know, as well as Nick coming from his background before he was on city council of writing insurance policies, which doesn't sound like it would be good training, but most of city council is actually a really boring job that involves, you know, sitting through committee hearings on zoning changes and parks. And
it requires a lot of patience.
It requires patience, but it also requires reading the fine print because historically in Seattle, the devil is in the details, and that's where they wind up funneling the money to all their developer buddies and such. And Licata over the years has been very, very good at getting changes in legislation that make it more palatable if it's bad legislation, or turning good legislation into very good legislation. So he's done a remarkable job in my opinion. I mean, he's really conducted himself in a way that has been able to balance staying true to his ideological beliefs with being effective and getting things done in a way that's very, very rare for especially long-time elected officials, especially here in Seattle, where you see so many of them co-opted as they stay on council year after year. People like Richard Conlon, who originally came in the same time as Nick as a member of the Green Party and wound up being one of the most conservative members on council before Shama Sawant defeated him a couple years ago. So Nick will very much be missed. At the other end of the in the pocket of downtown and economic elite interests in the city spectrum, we have Tom Rasmussen, who also announced his retirement this week. Now, he is not in a district that has another incumbent council member. He lives in West Seattle and was thought to be running for re-election. And in fact, his retirement announcement came as quite a bit of a surprise. He has a fairly strong neighborhood-backed opponent who had already announced, Chaz Redmond, who now has to be considered a favorite in that race, depending on who the developer community decides to recruit to replace Rasmussen, who will probably get a lot of the money in opposition to Redmond. But Rasmussen has very much done the bidding of people who have been funneling money into developers' hands, people who have been making very bad transportation and housing decisions over the past number of years. He has, in his past couple of runs for re-election, raised more money than any other member of the council, primarily from large business interests. And so, you know, Rasmussen's retirement is going to open up an opportunity in West Seattle for Redmond or some other progressive person to come on and replace him. We've seen in several other districts where progressive community members have announced or are considering announcing to run for council this year, which was part of the whole idea behind the district system, is to make it less dead certain that incumbents are going to coast to re-election, and that it makes it more possible for community members to wage credible campaigns. That does appear to be what is happening. So Nick's retirement is very much a loss for council. At the same time, it looks like things will be shaking up this year, and there will be an opportunity to get a new generation of leadership on the council as well.
All right. Moving on, the homeless one-night count happened this week.
Yeah, the annual one-night count of the homeless this week concluded on Friday with some pretty grim statistics. There was a 21% increase in the homeless population in King County over the past year, for a total of about 3,772 people who were counted. That's just the people that could be found. There are a lot of people who are homeless who hide away at night, and it's difficult to find them to count.
Or they're sleeping on couches or sleeping in their cars in mobile locations, mm-hmm. et cetera. So
places where it's hard for you to count them if you're out and about. Now, I should point out, too, that the city of Seattle, where most of those homeless people live, only has about 1,700 shelter beds, and the mayor recently announced adding, a couple hundred, not nearly enough to serve the people who really need it. Of course, that means if you do the math, that means that more than 2,000 people end up without a place to go on any given night.
Yeah, and I think actually that number is vastly undercounted. The primary benefit of the one-night count is that it's an apples-to-apples comparison over the years, because it's undercounted every year. But anecdotally, we know from what the shelters see in terms of the demand that they get that it's a larger number than that. And anecdotally, I think people have sensed that the homeless population is both increasing and becoming more visible in the area, especially over the last year. And the reasons for that aren't much of a surprise.
Yeah, and what bothers me is that nobody is really talking about the root causes of homelessness here. It's very obvious to me that the economic downturn, with its lack of jobs and with the fact that it robbed a lot of people in the lower middle class of all of their wealth by taking their housing away from them, by forcing them into bankruptcy, kicking them into the role of renters, and expanding the rental population here in the renter population here in the city of Seattle. That's also created a situation where big investment companies are pouring money into the housing market here in the city of Seattle, buying up apartment buildings and rapidly gentrifying and raising rental rates here in the city of Seattle, which is pushing even more people out on the streets. So people who lost their homes during the economic downturn starting in 2007 and 2008, who may have also lost their jobs as well, who have been kicked into the rental population, are now being kicked out of their formerly inexpensive older apartment onto the street so that apartment can be fixed up or torn down and rebuilt for a higher paying clientele.
Yeah, and let's be clear that these are very intentional policies by the city of Seattle.
Not do anything to stop the redevelopment of the older housing stock.
Yeah, and not just not do anything, but they're actively encouraging through upzones and such the tearing down of affordable housing stock. And then at the same time, Mayor Murray deserves credit for putting more money into shelter services and into
that's a Band-Aid.
A couple of dozen permanent housing slots for homeless people. It's a drop in the bucket compared to what's being caused by policies being promoted by Murray and some of the other same people.
Well, and we should also look at a couple of other root causes of homelessness, too. Washington State ranks 48 out of the 50 states plus Washington, D.C. in the amount of funding we provide for the mentally ill. So we've had a policy in the state of Washington to cut slots for mentally ill folks in permanent housing, literally pushing them onto the street, which is a politics of cruelty, really. That in itself is also a major cause of homelessness in Western Washington, particularly in the city of Seattle, which provides more mental health services than anywhere else in the state, which is where, mentally ill people are going to have to be. They're going to have to be here on the streets of Seattle. Living homelessness and trying to get some of the services that Washington does provide, few though they are. Also, we have a draconian and punitive system of punishing people for drug offenses and addictions. Until we admit as a society that drug addiction is an illness that needs to be managed long term and start providing services for people rather than locking them up, turning them into ex-cons who then have a hard time finding housing and jobs after they get out of prison, we're going to continue to see a lot of homeless people with drug addictions as well.
Yeah, and both of those are issues that you can lay directly at the feet of the state legislature. We're going to hear a lot in the coming weeks with the new legislative session about the need to fund education, but over the past several years, actually the past number of years, the legislature has dramatically cut funding for really just about everything else in the budget that's related to the social services or you know, provisions for the general welfare
even,
as well.
Even state income for the disabled has been cut drastically. So disabled people have trouble finding housing near where they need to get healthcare services.
Yeah. So it's not just education that the legislature needs to fund. It's all across the board. And they desperately need revenue increases in order to pay for some of the things that have been cut and that are creating these types of crises and crises that cost the state more money long run. It's been a very penny-wise, pound-foolish kind of approach.
It has.
And those feet of the legislature are currently on the dance floor with lobbyists as we speak. So, all right, let's move on. SPD will begin testing DNA.
The Seattle Police Department announced that they will begin testing on DNA testing on its backlog of untested rape kits.
Yeah, and this should have been a front page story and a huge scandal.
And it was
scandal.
Not. Yeah, and apparently the SPD has 1,276 kits that have never been tested. In the past decade, the SPD collected 1,641 rape kits, but only tested about 365, or about 22% of them. That's less than one quarter of the rape kits that were taken over the past decade. And you may ask why. Well, the department has a policy, and an SPD spokesman explained what that policy was. The department policy was to only test rape kits from cases in which prosecutors had enough other evidence to file charges, which means...
Wait a minute.
and the SPD spokesman explained why. He said, well, we don't want the DNA of suspects who are not... guilty to go into the DNA database, the national DNA database. And
Put it there.
Yeah, well, the answer to that is the answer to that is that DNA needs to go into the database with a tag saying that this person was once suspected of rape, because as we know, rapists are often serial rapists. They do it more than once, and they often have more than one victim. And the way you catch serial rapists is you take testimony and you get DNA. And if you match DNA of a current case against DNA from suspects in prior cases, you've got a potential serial rapist on your hands. And that's often enough to convict a rapist in court. And if you don't test those rape kits, how do you ever get that information? You never do.
Well, and yeah, I mean...
And rapists can move from state to state the same way other criminals
do. And the reason I mentioned don't do it is not because that's not true, because that's very much true. But even if you accept the SPD on its own logic, you know, they're putting up a barrier which is purely non-existent, because they certainly expunge the records of suspects in other cases if there's no prosecution. Yeah. It's a very different way of treating an allegation against somebody.
Yeah. They box up and keep other evidence for long periods of time. So as Jav said before the show started, they boxed up and kept these DNA rape kits too without testing them, but they need to test them. And it just appalls me that it took hiring a female police chief to get this done, because this is not a new movement around the country to test backlogs of rape kits. This has been going on for years, where victims' advocates have been pushing other cities to do this for years now. And in Seattle, no one's asked the question. No one's at the SPD has said, gosh, what is our policy? Why aren't we doing it? You know, it took hiring a female police chief to do that.
And between this and how the SPD has been over the past number of years handling domestic violence issues, restraining orders, et cetera, there's a real undercurrent of not just undercurrent, but it's been very blatant in a number of cases.
It's a policy.
A number of policies of misogyny, of institutional misogyny within SPD, and in terms of how SPD handles not just suspects, but also crime victims.
All right. Let's move on to national and the Accountability Review Board at the CIA.
Yeah, the internal Accountability Review Board at the CIA, which was widely expected when it released its report this past week to back up a an earlier finding that the spying, which had been verified by an internal CIA audit, the spying that the CIA executed against the Senate Intelligence Committee when the Intelligence Committee was trying to review allegations of torture against the CIA, that the CIA had previously admitted that this was going on and this is a bad idea. The CIA reversed itself when the Accountability Review Board's report came out a few days ago, and said that well, first of all, there was also another major issue, which is that it confirmed for the first time that the CIA director John Brennan, who really should have been prosecuted long ago, is both on his actions under the Bush administration and his actions and ongoing actions with the Obama administration.
He actually headed up the torture program for a number of years.
Yeah, he did, and that he personally approved the spying on the Senate Intelligence Committee, but according to the Accountability Review Board, neither he nor his subordinates acted inappropriately in executing that spying on Congress. That likely to be something that Congress is going to be very, very unhappy about, and again, raises the question of the very, very poor record of the Obama administration around civil liberties, and in this case, not only upholding the law, but actively breaking the law. This, you know, for all of the bogus allegations of scandals promulgated by the Republican Party over the past number of years, whether it's been Benghazi or, you know, birth certificate or whatever it is, this is a legitimate one that people in Congress should be up in arms about. Republicans are not likely to run with this because, of course, they're perfectly happy to have torture also. But this is something that people should be very concerned about in terms of what the Obama administration's been doing.
All right. Well, speaking of the Obama administration, there was the State of the Union address this week.
Yeah, Obama's State of the Union address. What really kind of hit me about it was what the media picked up on. The media really focused on his quote about, "I'm not a scientist, but I know a lot of good scientists," and how that was a slap at the Republicans. And I looked at that and I thought, well, no, it wasn't really a slap at the Republicans. What it was a statement of fact. You know, he does understand that science does a good job of describing and explaining the natural world, and hence he was stating that, yes, scientists agree that global warming exists and is caused by humans, and yes, that at this point is pretty close to being fact. But by focusing on that,
it is fact. It's not as close to being fact. It is fact.
Pretty close to being what you would say solid fact. Now, the fact that the media focused on that meant that they let slip something even more important in his address, which was his call for Congress to authorize use of force against ISIL, which would then allow us to deploy troops directly against ISIL, you know, send the troops back into Iraq. Also, I thought it was very interesting, his quote, "I have no more campaigns to run." Now, I looked at that and I said, well, that really sums up Obama in a nutshell. He spent 6 years of an 8-year presidency doing very little of his own agenda because he was rolling the dice, hoping he would get a Democratic Congress, you know, hoping to get reelected, hoping to get more Democrats into Congress. And here he is, the last 2 years of his presidency, he has the worst Congress he's ever had. It's completely Republican now. And he's got 2 years to try through executive orders to get done some elements of his agenda.
And it really
made me ask, how well has that strategy worked for you, President Obama? It really hasn't, has it? Because if you hadn't been concerned about electoral politics, you would have had 4 years to get some of your agenda done with a Congress that was more sympathetic to you.
Yeah, and you look at the executive orders that he has done over the past couple of months that have been more pursuant to that agenda, whether it's been a relationship with Cuba or his executive order on immigration and so forth, and they're all polling very, very well.
Oh, yeah. If he's done those in the first 2 years of his presidency, he would have had a Democratic Congress.
Yeah, very, very likely. At the same time, it wasn't just the quote around scientists. A lot of the media coverage coverage of the State of the Union was all about horse race and, you know, talking about middle class economics and such. But those policies are dead on arrival because the Republican Congress will do this and that. You know, talking all about the politics of Obama versus the Republicans rather than actually talking about the content of the speech, whether those policies, proposed policies, are in fact a good idea and what the need would be and what the alternatives for those issues would be if you don't pursue Obama's policies. None of that happened in the coverage. It was all about the horse race, and it was all upon seizing, you know, particular phrases out of context, like the, you know, not having more races to run, or the quote about scientists, and analyzing those to death rather than talking about the big picture and the larger issues. Very, very poor media coverage.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, a couple of major pipeline spills this week.
Yeah, in the week where Congress is debating the Keystone XL pipeline bill in the Senate in particular, the House has already passed their bill. There were two major pipeline spills this week. A pipeline owned by Bridger Pipeline LLC leaked 50,000 gallons of oil into the Yellowstone River, which, yes, flows through Yellowstone National Park. The pipeline carries oil from the Bakken oil fields in Montana and North Dakota. The Yellowstone River carried the oil more than 60 miles downstream to where it was seen flowing into the Missouri River. Now, the spill also contaminated drinking water near Glendive, Montana, where the 12-inch steel pipeline broke. Also, this week in North Dakota, a pipeline rupture spilled 3 million gallons of saltwater waste liquid from oil drilling and fracking into the Blacktail Creek and possibly into a larger body of water that could carry the waste into the Missouri River. Now, the saltwater that's used in injection wells, which is what this contains a lot of – it's a much, much higher concentration of salt than you would get in ocean water. And that's can be lethal to freshwater aquatic life. In addition, if it's been used in fracking, which a certain proportion of this probably has, it contains unidentified toxic chemicals as well as oil byproducts like benzene, for example, which is all toxic to aquatic life as well and can leak into drinking water. Though we just learned about it this week, the spill was first detected on January 6th. Had not been released to the public until just this week, and no one really knew when the spill first started, when the leak first started, and what caused it. So we should be keeping all this in mind as Congress debates the merits of the Keystone XL pipeline. Pipelines are a hazard.
All right. Do you want to talk about the S&P, or do we want to jump to international?
Let's jump to international.
All right. Let's start with Yemen.
Yemen, yeah. In Yemen, we have a proxy war going on right now between Saudi Arabia and Iran. The northern Houthi rebels have been pretty broadly supported by Iran. That's where they've gotten most of their heavy weaponry. They swept into the capital and deposed the government that was put in place after the Arab Spring protests in 2011 unseated the former president, Saleh, who was a U.S. client. A strong ally of the Bush administration in the war on terror. Saleh used to stay in power and keep the north and south of Yemen united because he was from the north of Yemen, which is primarily Shiite. He himself was a Shiite, but he used to play one side off against each other and occasionally favor southern Yemeni tribal groups who are Sunni, and he used to turn a blind eye, if not sometimes actively support fundamentalist Sunni tribal groups who supported al-Qaeda. Now, the U.S. military, after Obama came into office in 2008, dramatically ramped up drone strikes in Yemen. Most of those drone strikes have been in the south of Yemen against Sunni tribal areas.
And they've resulted in very heavy civilian casualties.
Civilian
as well.
Casualties, so they've been widely unpopular. Now, the U.S. finds itself now in a situation where the government that we supported, which was run by a man who was elected president who was from the south of Yemen, we supported him. However, he allowed us to continue massive drone strikes against tribal areas in southern Yemen, so he did not have the support of southern tribal groups, which was why it was easy for the northern Yemeni Houthis to unseat him. We're now in a position where the U.S. has to choose between supporting the Houthi rebels who are enemies of al-Qaeda, but also supported by Iran, who is our enemy, or helping Saudi Arabia arm southern tribal groups, which may turn some of that weaponry over to al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula, which is based in southern Yemen. So we're kind of between a rock and a hard place.
It's a mess.
It is a mess, and not the only mess we've created in the Middle East.
And once again, the U.S., by kind of single-mindedly going in and saying, well, there's bad people here, so let's bomb them, with a sort of a one-size-fits-all policy that's been oblivious to the local politics, has wound up making matters worse rather than better.
Exactly.
All right. And situation in Venezuela.
Yeah, speaking of countries that are falling apart, Venezuela has been gradually degrading since the death a couple of years ago of President Hugo Chavez. And whatever you can say about Chavez in terms of human rights and income redistribution and all the rest of it, for better and for worse, he was also very competent. Unfortunately, his ally and the president who replaced him, Nicolas Maduro, is not nearly as competent, but it has some of the same authority. Authoritarian impulses, actually worse in many ways. And so Venezuela in a situation now where there are massive food shortages, literally lines that are blocks long for supermarkets.
I don't necessarily think it's all Maduro's fault. A big part of the problem lies with the fall in oil prices, which has been the main support line for the Venezuelan economy.
Yes, the fall in oil prices and also the new sanctions from the United States and pressure on other countries to not give aid to
Venezuela.
That being said, with protests and arrests happening this week, a lot of repression happening by the government as well. For example, the government banning photos in stores so that media outlets are having a much harder time showing just the extent of what the food shortages are. Maduro, at the same time, canceling his announcement this week for a new economic reform package and instead going on a sudden trip to Iran. So a lot happening there. The U.S. Behind the scenes and very quietly also providing aid to the economic elites who have been helping to strangle the government, opposing it very much. And we're also behind the U.S. attempted coup in 2002, which is still a very fresh memory in the minds of many Venezuelans. So that situation, both in terms of the problems within Venezuela itself and the U.S. role in trying to promulgate those problems, is very much worth keeping an eye on in the coming weeks.
That leaves us 1 minute to mention the Ukraine.
Yeah, some military news sites and publications released a story this week that the U.S. will be sending troops to the Ukraine this spring to arm and train the Ukrainian military, National Guard, and police forces. Also, these news sites verified that the U.S. government has been massively arming the Ukrainian border guard. So more moves for us to get involved in a proxy war in the Ukraine between the U.S. government and Russia. And I should mention, too, that while Russia considers Ukraine on its border as part of its sphere of influence, the U.S. government considers the Ukraine part of our economic sphere of influence and a potential, if not developing, client state for us.
Yeah, and there's a couple other dynamics here also. A lot of this is about oil and gas pipelines.
Yes, it is.
And whether Russia can export that oil and gas from the Caspian region to Western Europe or whether it has to take a longer route.
It would have to go through the Ukraine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's that going on. Also, the U.S. supported government in Ukraine, very strong neo-Nazi ties as well. Very, very concerning government and very concerning from a human rights standpoint. And yet they're more and more becoming a client state of the United States.
All right. Events.
A couple things coming up on Monday at 7 o'clock. David Rovics, the longtime progressive folk singer, is going to be in town giving a concert that's a benefit for peace in Palestine. That will be $15 at the door. Well worth going and checking out. A great singer and also some very humorous songs as well. University Temple United Methodist Church in the U District, 43rd and 15th Northeast. Also at exactly the same time, unfortunately, Monday at 7 o'clock. Sex Trafficking, Changing a Culture of Demand, a very good-looking panel that will be happening at Town Hall. $5 will get you in at 8th and Seneca in downtown Seattle.
All right. Okay.